Last lecture, we were talking about solving the initial data problem, and in particular, we went through this specific formulation called the conformal transverse traceless. And so, to begin with, I want to just give a simple example of solving those equations, and then talk briefly about some of the sort of broad issues that one has when trying to construct initial data. Then after that, we're going to transition to talking about evolution, and we'll talk about the generalized harmonic formulation, one way of sort of formulating Einstein equations as a well-posed like hyperbolic system of equations. All right. So first of all, an example. Okay, so to keep things simple, let's first just require that we have a vacuum spacetime. So we're going to set our matter sources to be zero. And then we're also going to choose this maximal slicing that I mentioned, which is that the extrinsic curvature is zero. And we're also going to set this transverse traceless part of A hat be zero. And so, yes, this first quantity being zero is called maximal, and this quantity being zero is sometimes called waveless, because you can kind of think of these degrees of freedom as, in some sense, being the gravitational degrees of freedom. But we'll talk about more about that in a few lectures about gravitational waves and how they sort of encoded in these transverse traceless modes. But for now, we're just setting those to zero. And then to make our lives simpler, we're also gonna use our initial data to be conformally flat. That means the conformal metric is gonna be the usual flat metric. So when for Cartesian coordinates, you know, just be a diagonal matrix with one and the xx, yy, and zz components. And then our boundary conditions. So this is an elliptic problem, so you have to specify some boundary conditions, which we're going to specify at infinity. So we're going to choose that the conformal factor go to 1. That way we'll just get a flat metric far away. And that this xi, the vector that we're going to solve for to construct our extrinsic curvature, is also 0 at infinity. And so our equations simplify a lot, and they're just the following. It's the Hamiltonian constraint, and then the momentum constraint is just this. So if we just chose sort of our domain, you know, to be all of R3, then we kind of made things too simple and we just get a trivial solution, right? In that case, we just solve this, we get 0 everywhere, and we can just set the conformal factor to be 1 everywhere. That satisfies the boundary conditions, and both these equations are satisfied, right? So then we just get Minkowski space, or one slice of Minkowski space. So that's not that surprising. But so let's try to be a little less trivial. And so one way to do that is, instead of just considering all of R3, we're going to consider R3 with a ball taken out of the center of radius R. Basically, we're going to say at some coordinate radius R, we're going to impose some extra boundary conditions. And that'll give us a non-trivial solution. So the particular boundary solution we're going to require is basically that this sphere of radius R is a minimal surface. So what that means is that if you take the divergence of the unit normal of the surface, then it's going to be zero. And so if we then write that for spherical coordinates, looks like the following. Also, yeah, so we first go to the conformal components. We get that. And then if we now go to spherical coordinates, we can rewrite that as so this S is just going to put in the point in the radial direction and be a unit vector. All right, so basically now we just want to solve this initial data problem with this initial data and this boundary infinity and then this inner boundary at R equals big R. Right, so if we just write out that equation, we get this. And this is our, so we still have, you know, trivial equation for the vector. So we're going to require that to also vanish at the inner sphere. So we still just have, for our momentum equation, a trivial solution that xi equals zero. But we'll get a non-trivial one for our conformal factor. And so we want to solve this at our little r equals big R. We want psi to go to 1 as r to goes to infinity. And since this middle term, this term right here is zero, we basically just have the Laplace equation throughout our domain. And so you can check very easily that the unique solution to that is just the following. That psi equals 1 plus big R over little r. And so that means that our spatial metric is going to be the following. And here I replaced this big R with M equals to R. And so does anybody recognize this metric?
That's sparsely.
Yeah. This is Schwarzschild and what's called isotropic coordinates. Isotropic because you have just this one factor that multiplies the flat part of the metric.
Although you have to fix the laps for that to be Schwarzschild, right?
Yeah, so this is just a spatial metric. So you would need like a lapse and a shift if you wanted the to specify that to
its condition, like is that something that you can choose or
Yeah, because basically we're just trying to choose we're trying to find gamma ij and akij that satisfies the constraints, right? And then the constraint equations are independent of the lapse and shift. We can choose those freely on our initial time slice. If you want a solution that's stationary for all time, then there will be a particular choice of the gauge conditions that'll give you that. Right now, we're just trying to specify initial data at one time. Okay, I just want to briefly mention some other kind of variations on this informal transverse traceless decomposition. One sort of another popular formulation for solving for initial data is called the conformal thin sandwich formulation. So in that case, so basically, what distinguishes all these formulations is, what is the choice of the free data and what is the choice of and what is the constrained data. So for the conformal thin sandwich, again, you're choosing the conformal metric, the trace of the extrinsic curvature. In this case, you choose the a conformal lapse, so it's a lapse rescaled by some power. And then you choose the time derivative of the conformal metric. So that's kind of in lieu of choosing this guy, the transverse traceless part. And in this case, you solve for the conformal factor and the shift factor. And there's a variation on this called the extended conformal thin sandwich, or sometimes just XCTS. And in this case, out of the lapse, you're choosing also the time derivative of the extrinsic curvature, and then again, the time derivative of the conformal metric. And then in this case, you get one extra equation, and then you're solving for the conformal factor of the lapse and the shift. So, yeah, and maybe we'll mention in a second sort of why it's of interest to basically have your free data be these time derivatives, because sort of a judicious choice of the frame usually argue that these time derivatives will be zero or at least small. All right, so, we haven't really talked about how one goes about choosing this free data to sort of correspond to the system you're interested in. So one simple idea is to use superposition. So let's say you have a solution describing a single black hole, main black hole, boosted black hole, or whatever you want, and you want to combine that with another black hole solution to get something described by a binary black hole that would, you know, merge and give you gravitational waves. You know, so you can basically just add the two metrics together and then subtract flat space. So of course, you know, Einstein equations are nonlinear theory. You can't just add two solutions to get a new solution. But you can use this as basically your free data, right? And then when you solve the constraint equations, you'll get some you know, extra correction. Your conformal factor, for example, will not be exactly one. Sort of how much it differs will sort of be you know, in proportion to sort of how close these two solutions together and how big the nonlinear effects between them are. So you know, a reason why we might want to have these time derivatives as free data is because if we're considering sort of the most common type of gravitational wave source, that would be a quasi-circular binary. That's binary where the two objects are going around approximately in a circular orbit. So approximate because they're emitting gravitational waves, so they're losing energy and the orbit is shrinking. But usually, a good approximation for an initial configuration is to assume that there's an approximate helical Killing vector. So here by helical, I mean that you take some combination of, you know, moving forward in time and rotating the binary at its orbital frequency. Then you basically get the same system. So approximately as you evolve forward in time, you just rotate by some angle in the azimuthal direction. So that basically means that, yeah, I mean, you're assuming that this is approximately zero. So if you go to a co-rotating coordinates that are in this co-rotating frame, then you can try to set basically the time derivatives that are your free data that you have control over to zero. That'll give you approximately an equilibrium system.
So the omega, what are the subscripts 0 and b? Is what this should be some property of the combined system, right? The capital omega.
This is basically the orbital frequency, this omega. Okay. It'd be like how fast the binary is orbiting. Yeah, it's just the ORB. That's not clear for orbital. Yeah, and you know, we haven't really talked about the matter. Have you guys done the tutorial on TOV stars? Yeah, right. Yeah, so that's an example of solving initial data, right? Where in addition to, you know, basically solving the Hamiltonian constraint, which gives you one of the TOV equations, you're also imposing that the matter basically be in equilibrium, that it's you know, a solution of the fluid equations with zero velocity. If you're constructing, for example, initial data describing, you know, a binary neutron star or something, then you would have initial constraints or additional constraints you want to impose on the matter that is kind of, again, satisfy an equilibrium condition like this. So when solving these, when constructing initial data, sort of the issues that people worry about are, when you construct this initial data, it's never going to be perfect, in the sense that you'll kind of always have artifacts from the fact that you are not starting your two objects, your two black holes, for example, at infinite distance. You're starting them at some finite distance, and you don't know the actual solution. Typically, you'll get a couple sort of artifacts from that. One will be what's commonly referred to as junk radiation. So you'll see some initial burst of high frequency gravitational waves due to the fact that you don't have a exact equilibrium solution. And another thing people worry about is because of these nonlinear effects, they're not perfectly taken into account. You'll have some orbital eccentricity. So you want to start with an exactly a quasi-circular orbit, but there usually be a small bit of eccentricity in orbit. So that's a lot of times you'll kind of have to iterate on these solutions. Take one, evolve it for a bit, see what its orbit is, and then make a small change to sort of reduce this eccentricity. Okay, so any questions about initial data? Yeah.
So, let's look at the Schwarzschild example. You solve that, and you get that the conformal factor is 1 plus big R over small r.
Yeah.
And then you press run, and you start evolving. Do you have any guarantee that is going to still be satisfied? Like that the constraints are preserved by the evolution?
Yeah, so when you say that that's going to be satisfied, do you mean that the constraint equations will... We mentioned that briefly a couple lectures ago, and then we'll give an example again for this for the generalized harmonic system, how the constraints propagate forward in time. Basically, the structure of the Einstein equations guarantees that if you solve the constraints at the initial time, and then evolve with the evolution part of the Einstein equations, and they'll continue to be satisfied at a later time. In the same way that Maxwell's equations guarantee that if you, start with a divergenceless magnetic field, and then evolve forward with Maxwell's equations, then the magnetic field they get at some later time will continue to be divergenceless. Yeah. So we'll actually go through
I guess it's more like you just assume that you cannot solve the constraints exactly, and you get that your constraints are epsilon.
Right.
Initially. Then as you evolve, is that epsilon controlled?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And we'll get to that today. That's a very good question. Yeah, that was actually an issue that prevented these evolutions of the Einstein equations from working for a long time. This question of whether or not the constraints sort of are unstable or stable. All right, any other questions? Okay, so so let's switch gears and talk about the generalized harmonic formulation of the Einstein equations. All right, so there are a number of different ways we can sort of make an evolution system from the Einstein equations. So I don't know if you've gotten to this one yet, but in one of your tutorials, you'll sort of work through the equations of what's called the BSSN formulation. That's a variation on the ADM evolution equations, which we derived in class. So the one I'm going to talk about today is called this generalized harmonic formulation. So it's sort of a different way of, first of all, choosing your coordinate or gauge degrees of freedom. It sort of gives a nice structure to the Einstein equations that kind of makes them sort of manifestly hyperbolic. So the idea here is that we're going to fix our gauge degrees of freedom. By basically choosing the box. Your box is just the covariant derivative contracted itself of the coordinates to be some function or some set of functions we'll call the source functions or H. And you notice that this is, this is not a covariant thing, right? This is, the coordinates. So this in general is not a like covariant vector. And in some sense, you don't want to, you can't use something covariant to sort of choose your coordinates, right? So the idea is that we're going to basically promote these source functions to independent variables, and then we can that are sort of constrained to be the same as the box of the source functions, and then that allow us to make some substitutions into the Einstein equations to put them in a particular nice form. All right, so let's start by writing down the Einstein equations in trace reverse form. So we kind of if we write out the Ricci tensor, one particular way that we can write it out is the following. All right, so as we noted before, the Ricci tensor involves second order is the metric, and so basically, this comes in different forms. Yeah, we have this one, and then here I've introduced this new variable here, which gamma a, which I'm calling that because it's basically just the contraction it's basically if you just take a Christoffel symbol and then contract the two lower indices, you'll get this. So the deriving the generalized harmonic formation basically comes from noting that we can sort of split off the second derivatives of the metric into this part here, which has a particularly nice form because it's basically just a wave operator right down the metric. And then all the other sort of second derivatives of the metric that we don't like can be written as this term here. And this is actually equal to you just crunch through this. Yeah, it's just equal to negative of the box of the coordinates. So basically, what we can do is, you know, assuming that we satisfy this condition, the source functions are equal to the box of the coordinates, or equivalently that this equals zero, we can just basically add this, you know, quantity which should be zero to the to our Einstein equations and basically switch out these gammas for our h's. And then when we do that, we basically just have this nice term here. And then all the other terms basically just involve the metric first derivative or the source functions and its first derivative. And so, you know, as we talked about on Monday, hopefully, sort of what determines whether or not the equation is you know, strongly hyperbolic or not is basically just the principal part, the part with the highest number of derivatives. And because we're considering these h's to be independent variables, you know, we're able to make the substitution, and in this case, this is just the principal part. And you can see this is, you know, really just the wave operator on our space-time metric. So it's sort of manifestly hyperbolic, you know, as long as basically we have, you know, a single future pointing time direction. So, you know, what we do have to do is, in addition to using this evolution equation to evolve our metric, we also need to specify some equation for our source functions. That's how we're going to sort of choose our gauge. So, you know, in general, you can sort of imagine any sort of evolution equation for the source functions that you want. So, in practice. Well, yeah, so that's the most general thing. And in practice, sort of simpler choices tend to do well. So one simple choice that doesn't spoil the nice hyperplicity here is just to set the source functions to be some function of the metric. So if we do that, then if we take first derivatives of the source functions, we just get first derivative of the metric So then this is still not affecting the principal part of our equations, right? And sort of the simplest example of that would just be set these to zero, right? So that's called harmonic gauge.
What is the L operator? Is what I understood, we need to choose HA such that they don't fidget with the principal part. So an HA having a being a function of GAB but not derivative of GAB will not.
Yeah, so here this is just some arbitrary evolution operator. Yeah, so I'm just saying in general, like we could imagine, you know, we write down some equation for H, like, you know, its time derivative is equal to some function or something like that. So as long as we have some like, you know, first order evolution equation for H, it's fine. But we can do something even simpler, which would just be makes H some explicit function of the metric. Yeah. So this
would be a more general case, but
yeah. So in practice, this is what people tend to do. All right, so yeah, so basically the idea is that we in our evolution variables are going to be a metric. The time derivative of the metric, the source functions, and the time derivative of the source functions. And then we're going to evolve them according to this equation. And you know, some evolution equation for the source function there. Okay, so now we might have a worry, which is that, you know, we're only solving the Einstein equations basically if we have this constraint. That our source functions are the same as the box of our coordinates. I mean, we don't get to choose this, right? We're saying we choose this, and we evolve. And at some later time, we can just take our metric and calculate this quantity and check if it's true. So how do we know that it is true? So, you know, basically to derive the generalized harmonic equations here, we just added derivatives of this to our Einstein equations, right? Because we're saying this should just be zero. So if we just explicitly keep those, that's just another way of writing the generalized harmonic equations, right? Or the, you know, with the second derivative, like the second derivative metric that you get here cancel out with the ones that you get right there. Right, so then basically if we, you know, project with two unit normals, we'll just get the Hamiltonian constraint on the right hand side, right? Or sorry, on the left hand side, we'll get.
We want CA to be zero throughout the evolution. So, but what you're saying is, the derivative will also be zero.
Right. So, what we're going to do is basically we want to, argue that that this will be zero for all time. So we can certainly choose. So certainly we'll have to choose our gauge such that it's zero at t equals zero, right?
Yeah.
Right. But then now we're going to make a couple other arguments to try to argue that it's going to be zero for all time. So the first one is that we have this equation. If we project, we hit the left-hand side with the unit normal NA times NB, and that's just how we derive the Hamiltonian constraint, right?
My question was that how are we justifying taking that equation, that the right-hand side is derivative, covariant derivative of CB, of the constraint?
Okay, this is just the generalized harmonic equation. So this is what we're actually using to evolve, right? Because I basically just took the Einstein equations and switched out the big gamma A's for the HA's, right? That's equivalent to just adding this, right?
Okay.
This is what we're actually evolving with, right? Because you get some, gamma A's here, and then they cancel with the gamma A's here, and then you instead get the HA's. So this is the generalized harmonic equation that we're evolving with. Right. So if we use this, we just get the Hamiltonian constraint. On the left-hand side, and if we apply the projection operator and the unit normal, then we get the momentum constraint. So basically, what that means is that satisfying the constraint equations at your initial time is equivalent to, the CA being CA and its time derivative being zero at our initial time. Right, so basically we've kind of shuffled our constraint equations, and now choosing initial data that satisfies these basically guarantees that the time derivative, basically, this is equivalent, these four equations equal zero is equivalent to our momentum and Hamiltonian constraint. So now we just need to argue that starting with these initial conditions, that this CA will continue to be zero if we evolve with this.
How it's that, because the Hamiltonian and the momentum constraints are a total of four equations, but CA equals zero, that's four equations, and del T of CA equals zero, that's another four equations.
So in some sense, you could say these are equivalent to this, but then we also have some initial metric, right? So we're choosing this initial data, right? And from that, you could just calculate what the source functions are, right?
Is given by the initial data, and the constraints guarantee that its derivative is zero.
So you better choose your source functions to be compatible with this. Sometimes you can't choose these independently. Okay, so if we Basically take this equation, subtract like 1/2 ab times the trace, then we get following. Okay, and now we're going to take the divergence of both sides. All right, so we're just gonna apply this to both sides. So for the left-hand side, we take the divergence of this, what do we get? Yeah, and why is that?
Einstein
Bianchi identity. Yeah, exactly. By the Bianchi identity. And then if we take the, we apply this divergence of the operator here, what do we get?
Again, zero.
Yeah, that's just, and what guarantees that? Exactly. So then we're basically just left with this right hand side. And that's why we just said the Bianchi identity and conservation of stress energy. And then basically we need to just use the Ricci tensor to commute derivatives here. So and note that we want to switch around these Christoffel symbols. So basically the Riemann tensor gives you the commutator relation for the Christoffel symbols. We plug this in here. At the end of the day, we just arrive at this. So that's our evolution equation for the constraints. Basically, evolving with our generalized harmonic equation implies this evolution equation for the constraints.
Could you repeat what you did there at the top corner? Del.
This is. I was just. Basically, we have. So we have like the. Be helpful if I write out one more line. This equation is equivalent to. right? So we have these two guys that have basically opposite order of the indices, right? We just want to basically take this guy here and rewrite it in terms of the other one. But when we, you know, they don't commute, we pick up this extra Riemann tensor. That's where this guy comes from. All right. And so, you know, basically, this is just, you know, some wave type equation with some, you know, nonlinear or some source term that involves the Ricci tensor. And so from that, we can see that, you know, if we start with, you know, initial data, where the CA and its sine derivative are initially zero, and then we evolve with the generalized harmonic equations, then we're basically, constraints will evolve with this. And so you can see if we start off zero, then this being zero for all time is the solution you get. All right. Any questions?
So here, if we start with CA is equal to zero, DT CA is equal to zero, you're saying that that equation has a unique solution, which is just zero?
Yeah.
Okay. So that. That's like some Poisson equation.
So this is the four-dimensional one, so it's more like a wave equation.
So, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's basically like, think of it like a wave equation. But then they have some extra force here.
Okay. I see. Okay.
Yeah, so this being zero is sort of guaranteed by the exact equations, but you know, as there was a question before of, you know, for example, if you're numerically constructing initial data or numerically evolving it, you won't exactly solve the constraints. So, you know, what happens? In general, you know, when you do a numerical simulation, for example, you always want to do a convergence study where you do a simulation at some grid resolution, then you increase the grid resolution, see how your solution changes. So sort of a very non-trivial test is that, you know, for example, you look at some norm of your constraints as you evolve with time. So say, you know, get that at some low resolution, then you sort of know things are working if, as you increase the resolution, these constraints are converging to zero. So that's a sort of very non-trivial check because basically, if you do almost anything wrong, you won't get this quantity converging to zero. You'll notice that, you know, if we don't initially solve the constraints, then we don't have this equation, so constraints won't converge. If we use the wrong evolution equations, then we're not guaranteed to have our constraints say zero, so they won't necessarily converge. And even if we couple the Einstein equations to some matter, and that we don't evolve that matter correctly, so it doesn't evolve, it doesn't satisfy stress energy conservation, then even then our constraints won't converge, right? So in some sense, you know, we have written down this nice strongly hyperbolic formulation of the Einstein equations, you might think, okay, we're done. We just need to evolve with these. But you know, as you brought up, you know, there's a question of, okay, maybe the constraints are converging as you increase the resolution, but what guarantees that they'll sort of be under control, that they won't blow up? And so actually, you know, what you find if you do, if you just take the generalized harmonic equations as I've written them down and try to evolve them around, you know, black hole or binary black hole spacetime, is you won't actually see something like this. You'll see something more like this. You know, it'll go exponentially in time. And, you know, of course, you can increase the resolution. It'll start smaller, but it'll still increase exponentially. So, you know, that'll severely limit how long you can evolve things before your solution is just, you know, very bad.
When we evolve this numerically, means in this case, CA would be zero. In exact situation, we know CA would be zero. So when you evolve the equation, do you put CA is equal to zero in the Einstein's equation when you evolve the Einstein's equation?
Right. So I mean, you're basically evolving it in this form, right? So it's the same as
Put
the top equation, but just replacing gamma by minus H. So CA doesn't really appear in that. But implicitly, it is there, right? Because, yeah.
So this is separate. The evolution means while putting it on a computer, you can evolve stuff.
Yeah. So this evolution, you're not explicitly evolving this. This is just the implied evolution equation.
Okay.
Because it follows from this.
Yeah.
Right. So that was a problem that kind of stumped people for a little bit, but actually, there's a solution. So you can kind of think of the problem here is that, you know, you can kind of think of a solution space of the of solutions to the generalized harmonic equations, right? So, you know, these evolution equations will allow you to evolve anything, not necessarily those solutions that satisfy the constraints exactly. So you can. And what this is telling you is that it seems like this constraint-preserving manifold is actually unstable. You know, if you have your sort of space of solutions for the generalized harmonic, you can kind of think of, you know, there's this constraint-preserving manifold of the ones that exactly satisfy the constraints. But what happens is you go a little bit away from your, you sort of begin to diverge. So it's unstable. So the solution is to basically modify the equations off the constraint preserving manifold. So you want to keep the same behavior here, but once you go outside here, that's unphysical. So you're kind of allowed to do what you want. So the idea here is basically just to add an additional term to your equations of this form. You notice that this is proportional to constraints. So again, if we have an exact solution, this should just be zero. So this shouldn't change our behavior on the constraint preserving part of the manifold. But if you add this extra term and then go through deriving this again, you'll basically pick up extra term here. And so if we're sort of thinking of this as a wave equation, you can kind of think of this as a damping term. So kappa here is just some constant or some function that you're introducing by hand. And just from dimensional analysis, we can see we have two time derivatives here, which are two derivatives here, one derivative there. So this should have units of 1 over length. So basically, what you can show is that if you add this extra term here, then constraint violations should basically be damped away. Sort of growing exponentially, they should actually decay sort of on time scales or length scales of whatever kappa. Okay, any questions about that?
I have one question. I'm not sure I can formulate it completely, but typically when you have these kind of numerical instabilities,
mm-hmm.
you have two sources. You can have either higher modes that are making your system unstable because they are very high frequencies and stuff, but you can have also instabilities due to low frequency that are more dangerous because they should always be present. And here, like, just putting a damping term, it looks like the kind of thing that you do to kill the higher mode instability. Do you have also, like, infrared instabilities here on the constraints or not?
Right, yeah, so this is sort of like in some sense, even before you do numerics, this like instability of the constraints is already there, right? And basically you'll find that, it's kind of comes from this like a curvature here, right? So if you like substitute this Ricci tensor in terms of the constraints again, you basically get some like nonlinear term here, right? And like the nonlinear, the constraints satisfy some sort of like nonlinear wave equation, which is what makes it unstable. And sort of the length or time scale that is usually set by the curvature scale. So for example, if you have a black hole, typically what you'll find is that you need to damp the constraints on scales that are kind of like 1 over the radius of the black hole with the minority control.
So there's like a unique scale of instability.
Yeah, this is sort of going to be set by the physical problem, not by the,
yeah.
you know, like the grid spacing and things like that. So, I mean, you do find you need to do other things like, I think you're alluding to like a lot of times you have this, you know, numerical instability where, basically short wavelength loads that you're not resolving adequately can grow because they're not resolved. So like the usual solution there is to introduce some dissipation that basically represses those small wavelength modes that you're not resolving. So that is something that one typically also does in these simulations. But this instability is like doesn't have to do with a particular numerical method. And you know, here it's the time scale for it. We'll be sort of set by the physical parameters of the system.
I was maybe in the beginning when we set the that dark box of coordinates is h. In that, and the way the box x a came in the equation is when we define that symbol gamma a has gbc. What I'm confused about is gamma abc has derivatives of metric and then derivatives of metric. So from that, how is, like, there won't be any derivatives of coordinates there, right? Or I don't see, because the box on these xa's are just the coordinates we choose, right? Because we have the gauge freedom of changing xa to xa plus some, and we are trying to fix that. Having just derivatives of metric, somehow on the left hand side it seems has only derivatives of metric, on the right hand side it seems has derivatives of metric.
So I mean, you can think of, like, when you, like, if you take the ordinary derivative of the the coordinates, right, then you'll basically get like a Kronecker delta, right?
I see. So that is the Christoffel terms finally on the right hand side. Okay, with some deltas. Okay. Now it makes sense. Okay.